Okay, so thank you, Mata, for the introduction. I am going to show some relatively new observational evidence for the extreme growth of supermassive black holes and their host galaxies at very high redshifts. This is mostly or only observational work, so sorry, no fancy movies or simulations. As a compensation, here is a plot you've never seen before. Of the census of the local population of inactive black holes, so these are inactive black holes in the local universe, and I don't want to talk much about the correlation, this particular correlation between M and sigma in this case. I just want to focus your attention on this population of very massive black holes exceeding 10 to the 10 solar masses in the local universe, most of them in giant ellipticals. You can see some of the famous names here, and also a large scatter, and there was a lot of discussion about the scatter. So I would like to keep this local population in mind when I'm talking about the high redshift quasar population, because we think these are the relics of these very high redshift quasars producing the 10 to the 10 solar masses black holes. And of course, we're all familiar with this relation between black holes and their host galaxies, but there are some other links too, particularly between the luminosity associated with the AGN and the star formation rate in the host galaxy. And this is now a large compilation of sources going all the way from redshift of, let's say, 0.1 to redshift of maybe 2 to 3. And although there is a lot of scatter here, you can be quite easily convinced that usually it is the case that when we look at the host galaxy of a luminous quasar, especially at high redshifts, there is always a lot of star formation associated with this activity phase in the host galaxy. And actually, I wouldn't advise you playing the dirty sport of passing a straight line in this diagram, but some people have done it. So again, we have a lot. We have a lot of star formation in the host galaxy. And actually, we think we have a framework. I don't want to say a model, but we have a framework, a theoretical framework, which can explain this link and also produce the local M sigma relation, of course, namely major mergers. So whenever we have two large galaxies colliding together, a lot of gas is collapsing, going all the way to the center. We have a lot of star formation, which you can see here in usually, in most simulations, you will see two peaks, one of the first approach between the merging galaxies and the second one of the final kind of coalescence phase. And almost aligned with these phases of star formation, you would see the intense black hole growth, which is here in the upper panel in a relatively recent simulation. And it is also suggested that maybe only major mergers can really ignite star formation rates which exceed 100 or maybe 1,000 solar masses per year. So do we see this kind of systems in the redshift range of, let's say, 0 to 2 or 3? Some surveys have said that yes. You can see here some examples of major mergers hosting very luminous quasars, but same works have highlighted that actually some quasars are hosted by regular, what we now call main sequence star forming galaxies that show no sign of interaction. And again, going all the way from, let's say, redshift 0.5 to redshift 1 and 2 eventually. So if we want to see these violent mergers which triggered the most intense phases of black hole growth and star formation rate, maybe we should be looking at higher redshifts, faster growing systems. And now, to kind of end the motivation for our work, let's ask, where are these systems located in terms of the black hole, the AGN population at large? So what we see here is that basically by redshift of 2, the most massive black holes are already in place. Those 10 to the 10 solar masses that we see in local ellipticals have already grown. Till redshift 2, they're here highlighted in green, and we have actually more massive black holes here. They're already growing in considerably sub-Eddington rates. So you see here below 0.1 of Eddington, 0.1 Eddington. And even when we go to higher redshifts, let's say 2.5, 3.5, we're already again seeing a population of 10 to the 10 solar masses black holes accreting below Eddington. So the next natural step would be to go to even higher redshifts, which is the topic of this session. And this is what we did. So we went to, not to redshift 6 or 7 or all these rare systems, rare and fascinating systems. We stepped down to redshift 4.8 or so, allowing us to estimate, and I stress estimate, black hole masses in a large sample of luminous optically selected Sloan quasars, 40 of them, by observing the magnesium 2 line in the edge band. So this is actually what drives the selection of very particular redshift band. The nice thing about this sample is that it's large enough to be representative of the entire Sloan population at this redshift. So again, this sample alone, we have at redshift of almost 5, we have 40 sources with multi-wavelength data, which you will soon see. And it is actually almost a quarter of the entire Sloan population, which is just about 200 or so, at this redshift at these luminosities. So we are having a good sense of the population of most massive actively accreting black holes at redshift of almost 5. And again, we have black hole masses and Eddington ratios for all of them. These are the very simple numbers. Typical masses are about 10 to the 9, so very similar to redshift 6 or so. Accretion rates are high, higher than what we've just seen at redshift 2 to 3, but still actually a bit below the Eddington limit. So this is already interesting. The typical numbers are 0.6, 0.7, of course, highly dependent on your choice of bolometric corrections, but these are our best estimates. And so with these numbers in hand, we can play several games now. The first of all, relating to the review we just had about massive seed formation, is to try to calculate backwards in time the tracks that led these black holes to obtain their masses. So this is a very simple calculation. Each black hole is put here at redshift of almost 5, as observed, with the estimated mass, which is around 10 to the 9. And then we calculate, assuming an exponential growth, what would be the inferred seed, black hole seed mass at, let's say, redshift 20. And the thick lines here are kind of the typical, using the typical numbers that I just gave you for the entire sample. And as you can see, we can easily match, let's say, seed formation models which don't exceed 10 to the 6 solar masses. The only issues that I would like to highlight here is, first of all, as Priya just mentioned, the most massive subsample at every given redshift is an issue, is a challenge. You can only do this if you assume low efficiencies, as you can see here, and if you assume continuous accretion at this high Eddington ratio of, let's say, 0.7, all the way from redshift 20 to redshift 5, which I don't know how you can do that with just one everlasting accretion disk or something like that, but that's the only thing which can explain these masses. Actually, again, just to highlight how these sources are important in the overall evolution, we have the Sloan sources that I discussed earlier, and now we are going to higher and higher redshifts, 2.5, 3.5, and now almost 5, and then the rare sources at redshift 6, and you can see the buildup of these very massive black holes. So with all this information about the black holes, what can we say about the host galaxies? So for this, we had to turn to a very different wavelength regime, namely Herschel. Herschel. So we surveyed all 40 sources with Herschel, with far infrared imaging. We have actually, we're probing exactly the peak of the coal dust emission, which is a good tracer for star formation, although not a unique, maybe not uniquely associated to star formation. These maps of some of the sources have very poor resolution, but still we are able, with the use of some other data, we are able to determine far infrared luminosities for all these sources and actually detect significant emission in 10 of them, which is about one quarter. And for the rest of the sample, for the 30 or so sources, we detect a significant stack source, meaning representing kind of the average star formation rate ongoing in the majority of the sample. So from far infrared luminosities, we can then deduce star formation rates. And as you can see, and these are just some examples of five of the sources. Again, you can see here Sloan spectroscopy, then H-band, K-band spectroscopy. These little blimps of data took 3 hours each on the VLT, so please respect them. And then the Herschel results over here, much more significant than any possible AGN associate contribution. And again, we suggest that these numbers relate to very high star formation rates of the sort that you usually see in submillimeter galaxies or indeed merger events. And as I said, the stacked source, which represents over 3/4 of the sample, has much lower star formation rates, but still an interesting number by itself. And again, we can think about this very homogeneous or almost homogeneous sample of black holes at redshift 5 as hosted by two distinct subgroups of host galaxies, those that we managed to detect with Herschel and those that we didn't. Star formation rates can differ by almost an order of magnitude, let's say a factor of 5. Black hole mass is also slightly higher for the more extremely star-forming galaxies, so this is already interesting. And in our new paper, we are actually discussing and speculating and do a lot of hand-waving about different explanations for these data, but just very basic ideas that you might consider already is that maybe the Herschel detected sources sit way above the main sequence, kind of indeed tracing major mergers, while the lower star formation ones are being fed by streams or something less violent, something that can maintain lower star formation rates, maybe for more prolonged periods. And maybe we're just looking at some feedback. So the AGNs in 3/4 of the sources managed to push down star formation by a factor of 5 or so. If this is indeed the case, this feedback should be relatively fast. It should happen within 100 mega years or so. Another interesting thing that you should keep in mind is that, again, these black holes can reach 10 to the 10 solar masses way before redshift 3.5. They're actually, again, the progenitors of probably things like M87 in the local universe. And so if we have this kind of difference in star formation rates, maybe these systems will end up on very different locations on the M-sigma relation, on the relic local M-sigma relation, and might actually explain some of that large scatter that we see at the high end of the M-sigma relation. Indeed, if you can do, and we actually do it, in the paper, we play some games with the numbers, we extrapolate some growth scenarios for the hosts, for the black holes, and we, of course, naturally, with these numbers in mind, we reach a factor of 2-3 difference in, let's say, the M star to M black hole ratio for the different sources. Another speculation that we might do is, again, if all our Herschel detections are indeed driven by major mergers, then we see a break in this trend, which was recently identified, of higher luminosity sources being driven by, in a more and more significant way, by major mergers. So again, we see only 1/4 of the sources having star formation rates which are similar to submillimeter galaxies or things like that, although their luminosities are probably the highest you can see, especially in these high redshifts. So I'm almost out of time. I just want to emphasize that, observationally speaking, there is only one way to really, or a couple of ways, to understand the host galaxy of these systems, and this is to use ALMA. So in this case of source at redshift 5, just half an hour with ALMA, and this is ALMA of 2 years ago, so this should take much shorter exposure times. By now, you can resolve a major merger and have dynamical masses from line widths, from molecular line widths, for the two subcomponents, and actually deduce dynamical masses of the gas, traced by the gas for the two subsystems. And just another last point, again, an observational emphasis. All the large simulations could be much more useful to observers if they would trace the expected number of neighbors. So maybe the cosmological neighborhood of these fast-growing systems could be the way to differentiate between different halos and thus different seed production mechanisms and so on. So I'll just leave my summary here because I'm out of time, and thank you.
Thank you very much, Benny. And let's start, Bhaskar.
Just a question about the comment you made that the black holes tend to be more massive in the systems that also have slightly higher star formation, right?
Right.
So are these systems like merger prone events, or are they non-merger prone events? Because I guess I'm aiming at the idea of that if they were not merger prone, you could think of it as what people call cold flows feeding the galaxy and the black hole alike with like some cold gas, whereas mergers would require time for everything to settle down and then feed both galaxy and the black hole at the center. So have you looked into that?
Right, so again, we don't know which is a merger yet. They could all be in mergers, but just slightly different phases. Let's say before the feedback has started doing whatever feedback does and after. But the most simple suggestion maybe would be that, again, the Herschel detected sources, which also have slightly more massive black holes, are indeed powered by mergers. So you just have much more gas, black holes have grown slightly more than the other ones, you have much higher star formation rates. And again, I would just, to put things in a more precise way, we have a big difference in star formation rates, but a much smaller difference in black hole masses, okay?
Yes, so about your very interesting Herschel result, I think, I don't know if it's a comment or a question, but it's important to keep in mind that it's possible that at this high luminosity, and especially for merger trigger AGN, about half of them, so 50% of the total population, can be heavily obscure. And so it really depends on what you call an AGN and how you look for them.
I agree. Actually, so I'll follow on this comment and say that these are actually, when you think about it, these are very crazy systems. You have more than 10 to the 13 solar luminosities in the far infrared, all originating from dust, but these are optically selected typical Sloan quasars, blue sources, which were picked up by their rest frame UV colors. So they are not, the point sources are not obscured, but you do see a lot of heated dust. So these might be the you know, the craziest of them all, the minority of the minority report. Probably the majority is obscured.
Very nice presentation. I just have a comment. I don't know if you can compare your results with the recent paper published by Lipsky and collaborators, where they have shown that actually Herschel-detected redshift 6 quasars show also an excess in the near-infrared and mid-infrared emission and with respect to standard SED templates. And this may suggest actually that the AGN contribute to the heating of the dust. So this could be a way to, you know, leverage the uncertainty on the far infrared star formation rate as inferred from the far infrared emission.
Right. So I'll just reply to this. Maybe I should show the STDs again. So for the most luminous ones, which are, let's say, these 5 detected sources, the far infrared luminosities are such that you can't explain them by any torus model. These dashed red lines here are actually kind of the worst scenario torus model for the rest frame mid-infrared emission that you might imagine, with covering factor of more than 1/2, et cetera, et cetera, from a physically derived grid of models of torus emission. But I agree that especially, and this is where the recent Lipsky result comes in relevant, is that when you go to the stacked source, to the fainter, Herschel fainter sources, these things begin to blend. And so I would say that maybe for the stacked source, our result is kind of an upper limit on the star formation rate, in a sense that indeed, maybe there is some AGN contribution there.
A curiosity, it was nice, this picture of ALMA you showed.
Yeah.
If you want to show the same image of the same system, not with ALMA, but with SDSS or something else, what would you see?
With SDSS, you would see the brightest ever red dot
right.
that your screen okay. produced.
Right. So my question is actually, so there are many works now that don't see signs of mergers in very bright AGN. Is it because really we cannot see them or because they're not there? So to which do you have a clue?
So again, yeah, I showed some of these same examples right. at the start. We really don't know. I think some of the works are just using multi-wavelength data from very small surveys. I mean, relatively small. Even Cosmos is small. So you're picking up the lower luminosity AGNs. You're not talking about the quasar phase. You're actually talking about Seyfert-like luminosities. And this is actually where, and it was just here, this is where this compilation by Ezekiel comes in very handy. These bolometric luminosities from here on, this is your quasar phase, and then the merger fraction is indeed high. But when you look at large surveys, when you can actually look at the host galaxy, even do some, maybe even do some modeling and say if it's a disk-dominated galaxy or a bulge-dominated galaxy, these are all low luminosity. And you don't need a merger. What I'm saying is that you don't need a merger to drive 10 to the 44 bullet per second.
Oh, I agree. But my curiosity is more to see if this low fraction at low luminosities, just to know from also modeling point of view, is it really because you don't have a merger or because you cannot see it? And if you could actually...
I think, well, you know, Ezekiel, can you comment on that?
No, if there was a merger, you probably will see them in many of them. So probably those are secularly triggered AGNs.
Right. Ooh. Could have taken him to the bathroom down there.
So the next talk will be by Michael Tremmel, and he will talk about the early growth of supermassive black holes in cosmological simulations, the role of advection.